Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Park Ranger Bud Connor looked out across the gently lapping waters toward the distant towers of Chicago, silhouetted under the slowly reddening sky, as he took a moment to enjoy the last of the day's sun. Saturday, July 2nd, 1966, had been a hot one at the Indiana Dunes State Park, where Bud had been busy keeping watch over the thousands of day trippers there to enjoy the July 4th weekend. The park, located on the southern shore of Lake Michigan, was comprised of over 2,000 acres of sand dunes and rugged grassland, as well as a 15-mile stretch of sandy beach. And on days like these, it was just about the most popular place in the state. Letting out a sigh of relief at having made it through without incident, Bud turned and headed back to the ranger's hut when he was approached by a teenage couple making their way to the car park. It probably wasn't anything to be concerned about, they said, but they thought he might like to know about the blanket and a number of personal items that appeared to have been left behind on the beach. The items belonged to three young women who the couple had seen arriving around 10 a.m. that morning before settling down under several poplar trees close to where they were sitting. The couple were sure they'd seen the women boarding a boat on the lake sometime around 12, but hadn't seen them since. Bud gave a wry smile at the thought of all the young women he'd seen getting hit on by groups of guys trying to various degrees of success to get them onto their boats. Chances were, he thought, if these women had boarded one under similar circumstances, they'd be back soon enough to collect their things. Bud thanked the couple and waved them on their way, then headed over to pick up the items, figuring the least he could do was make sure they didn't get stolen. What Bud Connor couldn't possibly have known then was that he'd just walked straight into one of the greatest mysteries the American Midwest would ever know. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard McLean Smith. With most people having left the beach by then, it wasn't hard to spot the abandoned blanket laid out about 100 yards from the shoreline under the poplars, just as the teenagers had said. Moments later, Bud was stood over it with a look of deep confusion on his face. There were the usual things you might expect to get left behind, like the yellow beach robe, sunglasses and suntan oil, or the nearly empty packet of cigarettes. But there was other stuff too that gave him pause for thought, like the wallets, transistor radio, and even a set of car keys. Bud looked about the beach at the remaining couples and families in various stages of packing up and heading home, then down to the shoreline and out across the water. Where earlier there'd been hundreds of bathers and boats bobbing up and down on the lake. Only a few diehards remained, splashing about in the shallows. He looked down again at the items, then bundled them all into the middle of the blanket and pulled it up from the sand. A few minutes later, Bud arrived at the office of Park Superintendent William Svetich. After explaining what he'd found, the pair placed the items in lost property for safekeeping, then closed up and headed home. It was 2 days later, early in the morning of Monday, July 4th, when the phone rang in the ranger's hut. Svetich picked it up. It was a man named Harold Blau, in obvious distress, calling from Westchester, a suburb of Chicago, located about 50 miles west of the park. His 19-year-old daughter, Patty, had left with friends for the beach early on Saturday morning, but hadn't been seen since, and neither had her two friends. Though he knew it was unlikely Svetich would remember them personally, Blau proceeded to give a description of the young women, just in case. Patty, or Pat, was about 5'6", with brown hair and dark brown eyes. He believed she'd taken a bright yellow bikini to wear at the beach that day. Ann Miller, 5'2", with brown hair and blue eyes, was 21, and would most likely have been wearing a blue two-piece swimsuit with a red belt. And lastly, Renee Brule, also 19, was about 5'9", with brown hair and hazel brown eyes. Her swimsuit, according to her husband Jeffrey, was brown and had green flowers and gold leaves printed on it. The three would have driven there in Anne's 1955 Buick. Svetich leant back on his chair as he wrote it all down and peered through to the storeroom at the box of items that Bud Connor had brought in a few nights ago. After reassuring Harold that his daughter would soon turn up, Svetich hung up the call, then grabbed the box from the storeroom. Pulling off the lid, he took out the various items, including the bright yellow robe, just like the bikini that Harold had described. Moving it to the side, he spotted the car keys, noticing now the key ring attached to them, in the shape of a miniature Illinois license plate that read 265487. With it being so early, it didn't take him long to spot the corresponding vehicle parked up on its own at the far side of the car park. When he saw it was a Buick, his stomach dropped. A few calls later, and Chicago police confirmed it, the car was Ann Miller's. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Sign up today and start communicating in less than 48 hours. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. You can also log into your account anytime to send a message to your counselor. BetterHelp is not a crisis line nor self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online with a broad range of expertise available. And with BetterHelp's commitment to facilitating great therapeutic matches, they make it especially easy and free to change counselors to help you find the right fit. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Unexplained listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/unexplained. That's betterhelp.com/unexplained. Join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. With the Indiana State Police taking over what was now an official missing persons case, members of the women's families were invited to inspect the items left behind at the beach. All were confirmed as having belonged to Pat, Anne and Renee. It was shortly after noon when 39-year-old Sergeant Edward Burke, widely regarded as one of the best detectives in the state, arrived at the park and swiftly set about trying to establish a course of events. Having spoken to Bud Connor, Burke was keen to learn more about the possible boat the women were said to have boarded, according to the young couple who first alerted Bud to the items on the beach. However, since Bud thought nothing of it at the time, he'd neglected to take their details down, leaving Burke with only the vague information that the boat had headed west after the women boarded it. With close to 600 boats estimated to have been on the lake between Chicago and the Indiana Dunes State Park that day, locating the one in question would be almost impossible. Finding more witnesses who might also have seen the women would prove equally difficult, since close to 9,000 people were thought to have been at the park around the same time. With little else to go on, the next day, Burke initiated a full search of the 2,180-acre reserve and shoreline, enlisting the help of the Coast Guard, as well as 42 soldiers from a nearby missile base and 10 mounted officers from the Porter County Sheriff's Department. Meanwhile, police issued a statement to the press, giving descriptions of the women and asking for members of the public to come forward with any information they might have on them, or the mystery boat. Later that afternoon, witnesses from South Holland in Illinois and Indianapolis called in to say that they too had seen the women getting into a boat that day. They were certain it was the women in question on account of the unmissable bright yellow bikini worn by Pat Blau. Perhaps more importantly, they also remembered the man on the boat who'd invited them onto it, describing him as being well-tanned and in his early 20s, with wavy, raven-coloured hair and wearing a windbreaker jacket. As for the boat, however, they were less sure, remembering only that it hadn't been especially big, perhaps only 14 to 16 feet long, and was possibly white and blue in colour. By the end of the first day, scouring the park's dunes and meadows, sifting through every blade of marram grass, the search teams found no sign of the missing women. Suspecting they may have drowned, Detective Burke ordered a crew of beach buggies to continue patrolling the shoreline in case their bodies washed up in the night. But by first light the next morning, nothing had come in. The search continued through Wednesday, with an additional 100 volunteers joining in to help. But with no further clues on the women's whereabouts, Burke's thoughts turned to a letter that had been found left behind at the beach in Renee Brule's purse. Dated 2 weeks prior to her disappearance, and clearly written in anguish, it was addressed to her husband, Jeffrey. In it, Renee accused her husband of being more interested in his friends and hot rod cars than spending time with her. The marriage was over, it said, and she wanted a divorce. When Burke brought the letter to Jeffrey's attention, he was stunned. Though he wasn't so naive to think they hadn't been having problems, he hadn't fully appreciated the depth of Renee's misery. Renee's family insisted, however, that the fact she never sent the letter was evidence that she hadn't been serious about leaving Jeffrey, and had perhaps written it more out of frustration than anything else. Then a call came in to Burke from the beach. The search team had found a pile of debris that appeared to be pieces of a boat, loosely matching the description of the one the women had been seen getting into. It was found about 3 miles to the west of where they'd been sitting, in the shadow of the Bailey Generating Station, a large coal power station that sat at the far end of the park. The debris was comprised of twisted pieces of metal, oil-soaked wood, and large chunks of styrofoam thought to have come from the back of boat seats. Oil and gasoline canisters were also found nearby. Despite still no evidence of the women being found, police began to wonder if they'd been involved in a boat crash, possibly with a water intake crib, a structure designed to feed water into the power station that was positioned in the lake, close to where the debris washed up. But Detective Burke wasn't so sure. Surely anything like that would have been seen by somebody, and nor was there a record of any boat being reported missing on that day. and by the third day, even the boat lead was beginning to look a little dubious. With more and more people contacting the police, claiming to have seen the women, they soon found themselves dealing with a number of competing statements. Some had seen the women get onto a boat with three men, others that there were two men, or sometimes just one. The colour and size of the boat also varied significantly, with some saying it was roughly 15 feet long, and others that it was nearly 30 feet in length. On Thursday, July 7th, scuba divers and air patrols were brought in to scan the water for bodies and any more debris. Pat Blau's father, Harold, who was a member of the Illinois Civil Air Patrol, also joined the air search. In the meantime, eyewitness reports continued to trickle in, with most being quickly discounted, while others offered faint glimmers of hope, only to be quickly dashed when they were followed up on. When a rumour spread to the press that three bodies had been dragged from the lake, Detective Burke was forced to issue a statement denying it, while also clarifying there was no concrete evidence linking the boat debris to the missing women, something he'd himself become increasingly wary of. Then, later that afternoon, a report came in to the Indiana State Police from South Haven, a lakeside town in Michigan, located about 80 miles east of Indiana Dunes. It came from police officers who reported seeing three women wearing swimsuits and no shoes, asking for directions to Saginaw, a town close to Lake Huron, 160 miles away. The women said they were traveling from Chicago. It seemed unlikely it could be them, thought Burke, but it did make him wonder. All this time, he'd been acting on the assumption that the women had spontaneously boarded a boat for fun. But what if something else was going on? It was time he looked a little closer into the lives of the three women. Although Patricia Blau worked as a secretary for the utility company Commonwealth Edison, her real passion was horses. Having ridden throughout her childhood, Pat's parents eventually clubbed together to buy her a horse of her own, which she kept in Illinois' Oak Brook Polo Club stables, where Ann Miller was employed to exercise the horses. Over time, the pair had got to know each other there and became firm friends. Renee Brule was a friend of Pat's from their time together at Proviso West High School in Maywood, and had recently completed a course in medical technology in the Loop, the main central business district of Chicago. Renee loved horses too, and the three friends often rode together at Tricolor Stables in Palatine, Illinois. But there was more too. All three women socialized regularly together at a bar in Hodgkins, about a 20-minute drive from where they lived, where it is believed Anne and Pat each struck up relationships with married men. After speaking to a number of the women's friends, the police were surprised to discover that Anne Miller was 3 months pregnant at the time of her disappearance, while Pat Blau may well have been too. Miller had even told friends that she was planning to enter a home for unwed mothers. Something else of interest was a letter found by Harold Blau in his daughter's bedroom, written by Pat to her ex-boyfriend, John Paul Jones. Jones was 6 years older than Pat and had recently moved to California. Like Renee's letter to her husband, this one hadn't been sent either and talked mostly of Pat's unhappiness that Jones had left without even telling her. Jones, who was described by Detective Burke as an ex-convict and rodeo cowboy, who'd presumably met Pat through horses, denied all knowledge of Pat's disappearance after being interviewed by the FBI. However, when added all together, along with Renee's marital troubles, it painted a complex portrait of three troubled young women, each with a reason to potentially want to disappear. Warby Parker was founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty goal: to create boutique quality eyewear at a revolutionary price point. Glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. Sunglasses, progressives, and blue light lenses are also available. Warby Parker is committed to providing exceptional vision care online and in stores, offering eyeglasses, sunglasses, eye exams, and contact lenses. Just answer a few quick questions online, and they'll suggest some great-looking glasses that are totally personalized to fit your face and style. The best thing of all is Warby Parker's home try-on system, allowing you to order up to 5 pairs of glasses for free to try on at home, either for yourself or to get the advice of friends and loved ones before purchasing. Try Warby Parker's free home try-on program. Order 5 pairs of glasses to try at home for free for 5 days with no obligation to buy. Ships free and includes a prepaid return shipping label. Try 5 pairs of glasses at home for free at warbyparker.com/unexplained. That's warbyparker.com/unexplained. It was 3 a.m. in the morning of July 9th when the phone rang at the Blouse residence in Westchester. Pat's parents, who'd barely slept a wink since her disappearance, ran blearily to the hall to pick it up. "Hello," said Pat's mother into the receiver as Harold waited anxiously by her side. But the caller didn't reply, letting the silence hang between them. Unable to bear it any longer, Pat's mother burst into tears, telling whoever it was on the line, if it was Pat, that she had nothing to worry about and that she should come home as soon as she could. Then there was a click and the call went dead. The following day, at a complete loss what to do, Harold made an appeal in the press to Peter Herkos, a self-described clairvoyant from the Netherlands. Harold had seen Herkos on the news the night before, promoting an ESP card game in Hollywood, but the plea was never answered. When Harold had read his daughter's letter to her ex-boyfriend, his heart had broken at the anguish in her words, breaking all the harder at the thought that he might never get the chance to console her over it. Either way, he just simply couldn't believe that she would deliberately disappear, as some were beginning to suggest, not least of all because of her horse, who she'd named Hank, who meant more to her than anything else in the world. In recent months, thanks to Pat's hard work and dedication, Hank had developed into an impressive thoroughbred. Only days before her disappearance, Hank had won a race in Winnipeg, Canada, and was due to race again on July 11th. As for any suggestion that she might have drowned in the lake, he thought that unlikely too, since his daughter was a strong and experienced swimmer, easily capable of swimming over 20 miles. The only logical explanation, he believed, was that for some reason or other, the women had been abducted. On July 10th, Harold and two colleagues from the Civil Air Patrol mounted their own investigation of the lake and surrounding areas, flying to every airport between DuPage County and Ludington, Michigan, asking residents along the way if they'd seen anything. Back down at Detective Burke's office, after 6 days of searching, they had nothing to show for it except for a few pieces of possible boat debris and a handful of conflicting witness statements. When finally, they got a break. About a week after Pat Blau, Anne Miller, and Renee Brule were declared missing, a man from Ligonier, Indiana, contacted the police with some extraordinary information. As it happened, he'd been filming at the beach the day the women disappeared and had just gone back to inspect the footage after hearing about the case. Incredibly, he'd managed to capture the women, identified clearly by their swimming costumes, the moment they boarded the mystery boat. In the footage, the women could be seen climbing onto what was in fact a 16 to 18 foot trimaran with three hulls, with Pat in her yellow bikini seen taking a seat up front while the other two sat at the back. The man on the boat was also visible, looking just as the witnesses had described, early 20s with dark wavy hair. The footage was taken early on in the day, yet many witnesses were adamant that they'd seen the women back on the beach later in the afternoon. There was also the fact that many witnesses, including Robert Blatz, a lawyer from Gary, Indiana, also claimed to have seen the women boarding a completely different looking boat with three men on board. Blatz described it as being 26 to 28 feet long and possibly a Trojan cabin cruiser with no name on its side and a large radio antenna. It then occurred to the police, could it be that the women had in fact boarded two boats that day? After checking the footage again, a boat was spotted matching Blatz's description, and the police immediately got to work tracing its owners. Now with solid proof that the women had boarded a boat after all, more statements were released to the press, asking for the men seen on the boats in the footage to come forward, or for anyone else who might have seen them or knew them to contact the police. Another search of the coastline was made, with divers also instructed to check inside the water intake crib in case the women had somehow been sucked or placed into it. But nothing was found, and no one came forward. With Detective Burke becoming increasingly convinced that for whatever reason, the women would not be found at the beach, the search of the park was eventually called off. Then, something else came to light. According to a friend of Pat Blau's, the young woman had been seen a few months back with a bruise on her face. When asked where it had come from, she'd replied vaguely that she'd got into trouble with some horse racing people. Then another friend added that Pat had told her secretly one day that she was just going to leave and nobody would find her. This new information led the investigators back to the girl's personal belongings and to something in particular that had been found in Pat's purse, a phone number belonging to a man named George Jane, the owner of Tricolor Farm, where Pat, Anne and Renee rode horses together. Had the answer to the women's whereabouts been staring at them the whole time?
You've been listening to part 1 of Unexplained, season 5, episode 16, Built on Shifting Sands. Part 2 will be released next Friday, May 21st.
If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Or if you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters. Every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.